This is Infants on Thrones, the philosophies of men mingled with humor. We are the Quorum.
All right, so we're going to start the podcast now. So the genesis of this podcast started from what I remember, Mike, was the Born Again Mike episode. And
right, and to clarify, I am not Born Again Mike.
You are not
just to
born
make
again
it clear.
Mike. Yeah, you're liberal, wishy-washy Christian Mike. I'm sorry. Did I poison? No, I'm just kidding.
Yes, you did.
I actually want to flesh that out in a little bit.
Okay.
So it started a conversation with myself and Mike, where I was really interested that Mike was still self-identified as a Christian after leaving the Mormon Church. And I think I don't know where the book God's Problem by Bart Ehrman came up, but we emailed each other and decided it'd be really interesting to do a podcast on theodicy, which is what Bart Ehrman's book deals with, specifically how the Bible deals with the problem of evil. And then Mike said he had a friend named David who is on here as well, who's also a Christian, but ex-Mormon. And so we're going to start with Mike and also fellow infant Scott. Is with us tonight. Hey, Scott.
Hey, how you doing?
Hi, Scott.
And my older brother, Jimmy, is on. How you doing, Jimmy?
I'm fine. How are you?
Not too bad.
How's
so,
it going,
so just
not
just
too drunk either, so that's good.
Just to clarify, this is 3-on-2?
It's 3-on-2. Yeah, the cards are stacked against you, but really the purpose isn't to challenge or to attack you guys. It's more to understand.
So David and Mike are Christians here. Jimmy, Randy, and me, Scott, are the atheist camp.
Right. Yeah.
Just want to line that up. Okay.
And David, have you said hi yet?
Hi.
Okay. I'm just trying to get your voices in my head so I can tell the difference.
Yeah, I'm here. Yeah, no, I was the one that asked the question, the 3-on-2. I just wanted to know who lined up where, just
okay.
More for my own clarification. I mean, the numbers really didn't mean much to me. I just,
okay.
Just wanted to know.
Everyone's cards are on the table.
Yep.
So let's start with Mike. Let's talk about your relationship to the church, your exit story, and so forth.
Sure, yeah. My background is interesting from a Mormon perspective, and no one else cares. So I'm sixth-generation Mormon on both sides of my family, and my great-great-grandfather is William Clayton, the secretary of Joseph Smith and Brigham Young. And I come from a family. My parents had five boys, and my mom and dad were both born and raised in L.A., and then my mom moved to Salt Lake City. And I was raised in San Francisco in the Bay Area, so in the shadows of Berkeley, which is probably why I've had a little more of a liberal stint to my TBM-ness. But growing up as a Mormon, I mean, we had the typical, very strong, well, I wouldn't say we were typical Mormon, because my dad actually was published in Sunstone in the 80s.
But that was before the purge.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. So we weren't typical Mormon, but my mom was. My mom was very, very devout. My dad was more of a thinker, and I kind of towed the line between the two of them. Then as I prepped for my mission, I tended to gravitate more towards my mom. And then I went on a mission to Hong Kong and that changed everything for me. It burst my bubble, even though I grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area and, you know, had a different perspective. I did live for a brief period of time before my mission in Provo, Utah, for those people who don't know.
Not Provo, Spain?
Yes, exactly. And so, yeah, so I served my mission in Hong Kong. And in Hong Kong, that's when I started to really feel some cognitive dissonance about issues. And for me, it made me kind of double down and retrench. So I became even more obedient and more devout. And long story short, came for my mission, decided to go to BYU, graduated from BYU. My wife is from Arkansas, and she actually went to the University of Arkansas. So we met as full-time EFY counselors, especially for youth. So I did EFY for a couple of years, full-time. And then after we got married, she transferred to BYU, and I decided to change my path. I was actually considering law school and a couple of other things, and then I settled in on psychology and decided to become a full-time seminary teacher. So
what?
Yeah. Did you not know that?
No.
Yeah, so I was one of only 11 people that got hired from the 2001 group out of BYU. In fact, they wrote an article in the Daily Universe saying that it was more difficult to become a full-time seminary teacher than an NFL draft pick from BYU.
Oh, wow.
And so I went from a group of about 500 people down to just a handful that got hired from my original group. So I got hired, and here I'm this San Francisco, California boy who was told that my whole job was going to mainly be in Utah, and that immediately was an issue for me because there was a lot of things I did not like about Utah. But anyway, I got hired as a full-time seminary teacher. I had the whole general authority interview. I was assigned to Box Elder High School in Brigham City, which is Boyd K. Packer territory. Wow. And when I got out there, I think it took me 2 weeks before I requested a transfer.
What's that?
Brigham City, Utah. It was Brigham City. It was everything. You know, I'm an urban guy. It was way too small town. So many other issues. But it took them 2 years before they transferred me. And then they transferred me from there to Utah Valley. So I ended up being at Lone Peak High School in Highland, and wow. Which is the, I think it's the second largest seminary in the church. So I was there. So I ended up being in the church educational system for 7 years and prided myself in studying church history and doctrine and knowing everything possible about it, but I kept everything correlated. So I thought I knew everything, but I knew nothing. And didn't know that back then. But so then, you know, through multiple things, my wife and I decided to leave the church educational system, which was a big shock for everybody. But and of course, you have
at this point, your testimony isn't a reason for it?
No, Okay. Had nothing. The biggest reason was I knew we were going to have to stay in Utah, and it just, Utah was not, from the cultural perspective. See, back then I used to think that the problems with Mormonism were all cultural. So I used to say, like, I don't like this, but that's the culture. It's not the doctrine. Right. And I really bought into that until I started to see that a lot of it actually was the doctrine. So anyway, without boring you too much with my background story, we ended up moving multiple places. We lived in Missouri and then Arizona, and then we settled in Texas. And
please tell me you saw Adam's Altar.
Yes.
Oh, goody.
Yes. I've been to all the church history sites multiple times. You know, I actually didn't see the altar, but I remember asking someone, where's Adam's Altar? And then I thought to myself, how did it survive the flood?
And why is it in Missouri?
Yeah, and why is it in Missouri? You know, yeah, those were issues. Those were issues. But anyway, we settled in Texas, and I'm currently the chief operating officer of Anthem Strong Families in Dallas. I have 45 employees, and we do marriage and relationship education and parenting classes, anger management, money management, that whole thing. That was a big reason why I left, is that was really more of my passion. And so I quickly have become, throughout my years in Mormonism, the go-to guy for bishops and stake presidents, probably, and for some general authorities on marriage issues, on doctrinal issues, because of my background in CES. You know, I actually was at a stake conference where the stake president called me out of the audience to answer a couple of questions he didn't know. And so you get that as a CES guy. So I went from that notoriety doing firesides, even up in Frisco, Texas, northern, you know, the North Dallas part where we used to live. I did firesides and all kinds of stuff on marriage.
When were you doing firesides? Because I may have still been active at that point.
Yeah, I was wondering, David, how come you didn't recognize me from all my fireside days? No, you were already out.
Was I already out? Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, the firesides, like, we're talking 2 years ago.
Oh, yeah, I was out. Okay.
Yeah, you were already out.
You're so fresh, Mike.
Oh, hey, yeah. Before... I've only been out a year, Randy.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
So what happened was, and I didn't talk about all the way through, just like all of us, I was shelving issues, things that I didn't see. One of my big issues is most of my closest friends throughout my life, starting in kindergarten, have always been, you know, Black or Asian or, you know, lots of different ethnicities. And I had major issues with the racism in the Book of Mormon, the, you know, the history of Blacks in the priesthood. All that stuff was always an issue for me.
So when did you start to recognize that these were issues? Like, was it coming up as a problem as a seminary teacher, or was
it? No, in high school. Okay. In high school. I used to have discussions with people about it, and I would defend, you know, I became a pretty intense novice apologist for the church. I had an answer for everything, but I didn't have an answer for that. So that was something that always bothered me. It always eroded against me. It just didn't make sense. I couldn't understand why someone claiming, you know, Brigham Young claiming to be speaking for God could say some of the atrocious things that I had read. And so I kind of created that mental gymnastics where you skip over Brigham Young. A lot of seminary teachers do it, where you're like, you know, Joseph Smith is great. Brigham Young was terrible, but he was a necessary evil to get to David O. McKay, you know? And so you know how it is. You have mental gymnastics and you reason it through, but that was always an issue that would not go away. And another issue of mine, you know, that started to become really a big issue on my mission was just understanding how you can, the whole works grace argument. I couldn't understand how you could believe in grace and redemption through Christ and then create all these other steps that were necessary to access the grace. I always felt like we had mediator for the mediator. And that was a big issue for me too. So those were two big ones that I was always having on my shelf. But then I'm also, you know, my background is in psychology and in sociology. And, you know, when you go to a place like Hong Kong on your mission, you meet people from every continent, multiple languages, backgrounds, religions, and you realize it's really hard to put everything into one box. And that was hard for me because I could see people literally changing thousands of years of their Chinese history to join the church. And that bothered me because I valued their history, and it was sad to see some of them have to let go of stuff that had been in their family for thousands of years.
And that's something you see all the time with missionaries is the cultural imperialism. Glenn's talked about it a lot, but they literally just, you know, these ignorant, young, white American missionaries come in and just rape the culture from the people that they convert and then try to give them homemade root beer as a replacement.
Yeah, and that, oh man, you're right on. You know, to case in point with that is we had a bunch of Chinese elders and sisters at a big, you know, zone conference, and the sister missionaries were American, and they made these really rich cakes and a whole bunch of other stuff like brownies, and all the Chinese people hated it. And they were totally offended. Because Chinese people just don't eat sweet food like that. I mean, it was just too rich. It just, their palates just weren't prepared for it. But I remember the sister missionaries saying, you know, I cannot understand how they don't love this. And it's a simple thing, but it was kind of one of those things that I had to shelf where I was like, huh, I can now understand why they wouldn't love this Mormon religion. You know, but then you just shelf those things, right? Because you're so TBM. So anyway, those are some things that were issues. But then by the time I became a seminary teacher, I really took it serious. Things like the object and design of our existence is intelligence, I just combined two things. The glory of God is intelligence, and the object and design of our existence is happiness. Those are two Joseph Smith things. I took those serious and then search out of the best books. So I would read science and history. I studied the history of every major religion from, you know, Buddhism to Taoism to, you know, the whole works. I mean, and I just started to develop what I felt was kind of like the secret universalist view, but it went in direct opposition to the dogma of DNC 130 of being the only true church. And so I had to shelf those things. But what really snapped it for me was, and now this is, I mean, this is, we're talking a year and a half ago. I had a buddy of mine who lives in Provo, Utah. He actually is the one who introduced me to Infants on Thrones.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah. But he gave me a call and basically said, Mike, I'm struggling with several things. And I said, okay. And he and I had talked about a lot of stuff. And I was always the go-to person for most of my family and friends, having been a seminary and institute teacher full-time. And he calls me up and he said, you know, just check these things out. And he introduced me to Mormon Think. And I had never been there because, remember, I was really obedient. So I studied all things correlated in Deseret Book.
What year was when you found Mormon Think?
So that was last year.
Just last year. Okay.
So that would have been, I can't remember the exact month, maybe March or April of 2013, maybe March.
Okay, so I'm curious about this because I've got a seminary teacher relative. So in the CES system, there's not like I always kind of thought there was sort of this underground current of like uncorrelated knowledge that's getting kind of passed around and talked about, and like everybody's reading Rough Stone Rolling or everybody's reading,
yes,
you know, those kind of controversial books and,
yes,
sort of talking about them, but never teaching them. Is that not the case? Cause I would assume that after, you know, some years in CES that you would have been at least a little bit more exposed to the types of things that you might've found on Mormon Think. It sounds like it was pretty jarring for you.
No, well, it depends on what you're talking about. So yeah, you're totally right on. There is an underground. I had a fellow seminary teacher who brought me the book Mormon Enigma in a brown paper bag and snuck it to me in my office.
Contraband.
like it's a fifth of vodka or something.
Yeah, yeah, no, it totally, I laughed so hard. So I read Mormon Enigma. I had talked to several seminary teachers who read Rough Stone Rolling, and I had only read bits and pieces of it, but never owned the book. And so some of the more, and this gets to some of the bigger issues. So I knew that there were issues that Joseph Smith lied about his polygamy. And I knew that there were, I mean, we could go through a whole bunch of things, but I knew that there were issues. But once again, you get really inoculated as a seminary and institute teacher, especially if you're an obedient one like me. You know, I was a very obedient, you know, if they tell me to not read correlated material or to read correlated material, that's what I'm going to do. And it's weird now looking at it from the ex-Mormon viewpoint. It just makes me feel like an idiot. You know, you look back and you just think, wow, I thought I was being so intellectual and so smart, but I had not been exposed to so many of the issues. And I'll tell you a couple of the ones that were brand new to me a year ago. So I go to Mormon Think, to the links that my friend sent to me. And the first one was on the polyandry. And I had never heard that. I didn't know Joseph Smith had married other men's wives. So that's how successful they are among the religious educators to keep that type of information away from you. That's because amazing. I read everything.
That's amazing, because it's right there in Rough Stone Rolling. And that's what started.
Exactly.
That's what started my faith crisis, was reading Rough Stone Rolling and learning, yeah, about polyandry. But you're in CES and you didn't know about it.
I know.
Yeah, that's
incredible control of information.
No, absolutely. Isn't that crazy? It drives me crazy.
And it makes I don't know. It's that fine line between saying that the church is, you know, deliberately hiding this stuff. I mean, how do you characterize it any other way than the church is hiding it? If somebody can make it through BYU, you know, growing up, a mission, seminary institute, graduate from BYU, go through CES training, and then be a CES teacher for 9 years and not understand something as fundamental to the founder of your religion as,
yeah,
you know, one of the major driving forces of like the last few years of his life, and certainly one of the major contributors to his death. I mean,
exactly.
It's just mind boggling that they can, you know, keep you again thinking that you know so much, because you're not going to go out and question, yep, when you already know all the tough stuff, or you already know all the answers is what you think. Right. Is that a fair way to characterize it, kind of, that you...
Oh, very fair. And yeah. Think of how sad it is that I was the go-to person for stake presidents and bishops, and for, I calculated, I had more than 25,000 students between seminary and institute.
Wow.
You got to contact each and every one of them.
No, I know. I've thought about it. I'm like, oh man, I've got a responsibility now. But you know, you look at that, and it is mind blowing to me that someone like me, who I've actually always been known as more of an intellectual person, but somehow I got into this. I just bought into the narrative, and I bought into the rut of, you know, following the correlated material. But once again, I was a little rogue by reading Mormon Enigma and other things, but I was totally oblivious to the online world. I had no idea. I'd never heard of John DeLynn. I never heard of Mormon Expression. I never heard of any of this stuff.
I think part of it is you spend so much time in so many boring meetings that at the end you end up convincing yourself, well, I've spent all this time, I better know it all, because otherwise, what the hell have I been doing?
Yeah, you're right on. In fact, that adds to part of my own narrative. You know, the Oaks family I'm very close to, and Merrill Oaks is Dallin Oaks's only brother, and he's like a second father to me, and I know a ton of general authorities, and you just trust people. You trust everybody, you know? And so I remember thinking, okay, this doesn't make sense, that doesn't make sense, but there is no way, you know, you make that logical fallacy of appeal to authority. And I think that's what did it for me, is I was constantly thinking, man, I know these guys. I know half the religion faculty at BYU, and they know more than me, so clearly there's no issues. And some of these questions would come up in among my seminary students, but I remember thinking, oh, that's just anti-Mormon.
That's the go-to.
Yeah, it is. And that's how you're trained. I mean, you're totally inoculated. It's pretty sinister if you think about, you know, that they even called us, and that they call these people religious educators for the church, because the five of us know more than the vast majority of the full-time religious educators in the church about Mormonism.
You guys weren't religious educators. You were propaganda pushers.
No, exactly. And there is nothing that makes me more angry. My angry phase of grieving was very intense on that one thing alone.
I have a question for you, Mike. There's all this, you know, hidden aspects of, you know, the sort of stuff that you're not allowed to see. But there's a lot of stuff that's just plain. It's right in your face. And it's the sort of stuff that bothered me on my mission and that I brought with me when I, you know, took my religion classes at BYU. And that is that the Book of Mormon seemed just implausible on its face. And it seemed kind of inferior to a lot of the stuff that I was reading elsewhere, you know, the Tower of Babel stuff, the Brother of Jared, you know, the young universe, all of that sort of stuff. Did that ever become a part of the issue, or did that come later?
It came later. Occasionally things didn't make sense to me, you know, but of course you always have that cop out where you can refer to, you know, some of the things in the Book of Mormon that say, you know, if there's faults, they're the faults of men, you know, those types of scriptures where you reason yourself out of it. But you don't really, you know, David was right on. You don't really have time. You're so busy, you know, going to in-service meetings constantly, and then you've got your callings. I was always in a bishopric or in a presidency. I mean, think of the countless hours you put into Mormonism. They make you so busy, you don't have time to think about it.
Yeah, on top of it, you're going to the temple.
Yeah, exactly. You're going to the temple.
Yeah. But there's that dark night of the soul feeling. I got this on my mission. I was a very dedicated missionary. If I was going to be a missionary, right, I was going to go all out. But I'd be sitting there reading in the middle of the night or during study time or something like that. And I would just read something like Joseph Smith cursing Salem or something like that. And just think, you know, he made this up. He made this up. And I remember actually feeling sick to my stomach and having a hard time tracting until, of course, I read the biography of Spencer Kimball, and if he believed it, it must be true. But that really didn't last very long. But you never had that kind of in the middle of the night wondering, oh, my God, am I believing something absurd, you know, because of something you read that day?
No, because I was the guy that stood up and said, I know as sure as this podium I'm standing in front of that this church is true. And I was authentic because I thought that warm, fuzzy feeling that you get through confirmation bias and telling yourself over and over again that it's true was the spirit. And I thought I knew. And so when you have that, you're filtering every single thing through that lens. And so it's just constant confirmation bias. I think it was John Larson on Mormon Expressions, one of the podcasts I listened to. He talked about going into a room that's dark, and you bring in a flashlight and you may shine across different things that don't make sense, but you zero in and focus on the things that do make sense. But then eventually you discover a light switch that you flip on. And when you flip on that light switch, and that light switch is different for every single person who makes their exit, as soon as you flip on that light switch, you look at the room and realize, oh, wow, I didn't realize how much garbage was here. I didn't realize how much it was false. And okay, that, so this, for me, the light switch, going back to my friend who called me, when he directed me to Mormon Think, polyandry was kind of like half of the light switch. And then I watched the video. I don't even remember the name of the video, but I watched the video on the papyri in the Book of Abraham. And that was the light switch for me. But it was kind of the combination of the two. It was... there, I know the doctrine and I already have issues with polygamy, but there is no doctrinal foundation. You know, remember I was still a TBM. So there's no doctrinal foundation for marrying other men's wives. And so that just killed me. And I immediately started to view Joseph Smith different. I immediately started to see him different. But then seeing that video, the 1 hour video on the papyri, I had no idea, you guys, that the papyri was discovered. I had no idea. I was a religious educator. That made me so mad to think, what? No one? I know all these general... I sat face to face with 10 different general authorities having conversations. They'd say, Mike, ask me anything you want. And every time I'd say, is there anything I should be concerned about? And they never, obviously... never said anything that would give me any indication to be worried about anything. But the Book of Abraham combined with the polyandry of Joseph Smith, all of a sudden I entertained the thought for the first time. I'm 36 years old, sixth generation Mormon, seminary, former seminary teacher. And all of a sudden, for the first time, I entertained the thought, what if Joseph Smith was not a prophet?
Well, that brings me to the more germane part of your story to the podcasts at hand.
Right.
And so you deconstruct your Mormon faith. The narrative that happened for Scott, myself, and for Jimmy was that we took the same skeptical eye that we took towards Mormonism. We deconstructed Christianity. And that seems to be a pretty familiar, in my experience, the more common narrative. But what I want to ask you now is, after you deconstructed your Mormon faith, why did you stick with Christianity? What is your relationship to the Bible, to Scripture, and how would you self-define? What kind of Christian are you?
Okay. after the light switch going on and, you know, making sense of all that, of course, you know, I probably followed the path of most people. I was introduced to Infants on Thrones. I went back and listened to all of your podcasts, which was, it was awesome and entertaining. Cause I love humor and I love taking that more comedic approach. So I went back and listened to Mormon Expressions and Mormon Stories and all those other ones, but Infants on Thrones was the one that was entertaining me. And so that was really helpful for me to be able to, you know, continue to unpack. And you all pulled me out of the anchor stage a few times where I felt like a, you know, at least I can laugh about this. But, you know, and the other part of the story is having to tell my wife. And that's part of the narrative of embracing Christianity as well, because as I started to talk to my wife about the issues, her initial response was, for the first time in our 14 years of marriage, or at the time 13 years of marriage, she started to doubt me as a person, and that hurt. And it was a very painful time. It was very lonely because, you know, this whole world had come crashing down for me, and I knew factually that the church wasn't true, and I had to change my whole paradigm, but I'm doing this alone. And my wife, who's my best friend, I thought, how in the world could this mess up our marriage? And I was really worried about that. But one of the things that was a huge glue for us was, a few weeks after I told her that it all had come crashing down for me, and she hadn't read anything yet, it dawned on her that, you know, me as her husband and as the father of our three kids, these are her words. She said, you know, I don't know a kinder, more loving person, a more genuine, pure-hearted person, a more Christ-like person than my husband. So if he has issues with the church and Joseph Smith, then I better look into him. And it was at that time that my friend had introduced me to the story of Grant Palmer. And Grant Palmer was a big part of helping me unravel a lot of stuff, reading his book, An Insider's View of Mormon Origins, and then also his book, Incomparable Jesus, was a good bridge for me. And it was through the lens of that helped my wife open up her eyes. And then for the two of us to come together, we started to study. You know, we had to unravel it all and say, okay, what do we believe now? What's our belief system? Is anything true? And so what we did is we went back and looked at the Hebrew roots of the Old Testament, the Greek roots of the New Testament, and just started to unpack things from there and study from that perspective. And the two of us, and we'll get more into this discussion when we get into the discussion of the book, but the two of us started to, it was really our understanding of the Bible that helped us expose more and more of the fraudulent nature of what Joseph Smith put together in Mormonism. And so it was through that lens that actually helped us deconstruct a lot of Mormonism. And there's a lot more to it. I mean,
So Mike, yeah. let me just jump in here. So like biblical literacy sorry, that's not the right word. Not biblical literacy. the literal nature of the Bible.
You want biblical literalism?
There we go. Biblical literalism.
So
where do you fall on that?
So I
just give us like a brief synopsis of like your take on the Bible's role and like how you view that.
That's an easy answer. My view is that the New Testament is riddled with stories from Jesus that are all, not all, but the vast majority of them are parables. And therefore, I view the Bible from that perspective. So I'm definitely not a literalist when it comes to the Bible from the Old Testament all the way through the New Testament. And that's actually part of what undid a lot of Mormonism for me, because I think it's a silly notion for all these Mormons who think that they're not literalists, because the doctrine itself in Mormon scriptures lay that out. And so I came to the conclusion that I could embrace a belief in God and I could embrace Jesus Christ as God and not view the Bible literally from page one to the end, from Genesis to Revelation. So I have a very open, and as Randy puts it, a much more liberal view. I don't view it as wishy-washy.
That was just a joke.
So it's just him being pejorative. So
No.
That was tongue-in-cheek pejorative.
That's helpful.
Does that answer your question? That answers
my question. That gives me a pretty good idea of where you're coming from.
Well, I do have a question very quickly. And that's like, what literally do you believe, that's based on the Bible? In other words, for example, when Paul says that everything hinges on whether Jesus was resurrected or, so that sort of stuff. What mix of literal and symbol do you have going on?
Yeah, and when it comes to that particular, to answer that one directly, I actually do believe that Jesus was literally resurrected. But that's a belief. Obviously, there's no proof, and I can't give you any empirical evidence. But when something is laid out as clear cut as that and is so pivotal in the theology, I accept it as literal. But there's a lot of stories, to start with Genesis. I don't view the story of the Garden of Eden and Adam and Eve and the serpent as a literal story. I have no problem except, because I actually, with all of you, we probably could have a great discussion on science and physics and see eye to eye on evolution and other areas. So that makes me definitely very different from a typical evangelical or born again Christian. Does that make sense?
Does that answer your question, Jimmy?
Yeah, that makes sense. So in other words, certain of the basic things like Jesus's crucifixion, that it was redemptive, he rose from the dead. Some of those basic fundamental claims are the things that you're attached to. Do you have a tendency to read the so-called Old Testament like typologically, like in the sense that it really does contain prefigurings of Jesus?
Yes, I do.
Okay, great. Thanks.
I probably shouldn't say it because it's for later. But for you, the suffering servant mentioned in the Old Testament is not the nation of Israel, but it is actually Jesus.
I think it's both.
Okay. All right. So let's get to David because we're already like 44 minutes into the recording.
Jeez, I know. Sorry.
That's all right.
No, I'll try and keep it short and sweet.
But it was interesting because you come from CES, which Grant Palmer came from. And who was... Scott, do you remember the guy in Mormon Stories that he and his wife came on the end of
McClay.
Yes, I watched that, and it sounds like they got a divorce.
They got divorced, but that doesn't really matter to the
story. That was
no. But I just was trying to pinpoint who they were. Grant Palmer and I have become very good friends over the past year.
Yeah, he's got one of the best descriptions of Mormonism I've ever heard, and I've said it before. But he described Mormonism as a mile wide and an inch deep.
Yep.
And that I can't think of a more pithy way to summarize
totally.
Mormonism.
Let me give you one more quick summary from Grant Palmer. You'll appreciate this. I was with him actually, spent about 5 hours, and we had a great conversation. And we were kind of going back and forth about this and that, and I can't believe this. And we were just talking about a bunch of stuff that you would unpack as former CES and former Mormon. And he just stops the conversation and he just goes, I can sum this up in four words. Joseph Smith doesn't matter. And then he goes, you want to go get something to eat?
Well, I do take issue with his, I feel like he special pleads with Jesus, but that's neither here nor there. Let's talk about David.
Sure. Doing the story thing?
Yeah. Well, you mean you can do whatever you want.
I'm good if I leave now. My story's pretty boring. Born and raised in the church. My mom's a convert. My dad's also a convert. When I was growing up, it was off and on active. I was always active. I was kind of the active one in the family. My dad would drift in and out of activity. My mom was much more active, but so I was the first person.
What did your parents convert from?
My mom converted from Catholicism, And my dad, he was converted when he was like 10. So I don't know. His family was from Alabama, so I'm assuming some variety of Baptist something or other.
That's a good assumption.
Yeah, so I was the first person to, you know, to go on a mission in my family. So I got a call to Nicaragua, Managua. I was there from 94 to 96. And I was a, you know, straight-laced missionary, gung-ho, and read the Book of Mormon many times. You know, I was ready and rearing to go. And that was probably the first time I realized that the church may not be what it was. It was never an intellectual thing for me. It was just the first – it was – my first mission president was just a first-class dick. And I could not stand the guy. And you know, I was – you know, in the back of my mind, I'm like – why do they call this kind of a person to be a mission president? And I realized later that's probably exactly the kind of person they want to be a mission president, because he kept us all in line. But anyway,
dickishness is high on the list for mission presidents.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean one's own conference. I mean, he literally brought a missionary to tears just dressing him down, you know, just nitpicking every small infraction the guy had ever done. Why didn't you baptize? What time are you getting up? You know, all the petty, stupid rules that they, you know, he just went down the list and brought the guy to tears. I came home from that zone conference and I was ready to leave. I was like, I can't do this. And then I calmed down and I realized that guy was only going to be there another 4 months. I said, well, you know, I'll stick around another 4 months. And my next mission president was a great guy. And you know, I had a good experience from that point on. You know, came home, got married real quick, went to BYU. I didn't really enjoy BYU that much, even as a full throttle believer. But you know, I graduated, got my bachelor's, and jetted out of there. I didn't like Provo at all either. I was from California. My wife is too, so we jetted back to LA as soon as we finished. Anyway, so for most of my 20s and early 30s, you know, I was doing the active Mormon thing. There was always in the back of my mind throughout this period this nagging dissatisfaction, but never an intellectualization of why I was dissatisfied. And it would come and go. And I'd kind of reached a low point right after we moved from LA to Texas. And it was at that point that I got a call to be a early morning seminary teacher. So I was gung ho because I thought this is it. You know, this is my chance to jolt my spirituality into high gear. You know, I love reading scriptures. I love, you know, history, languages, and whatnot.
And how long ago was this, David?
We moved to Frisco in 2007. Okay. So I would have started teaching seminary the fall of 2007.
That, you know,
it's a very familiar story.
Yeah, what you're about to say in terms of this being your trigger, my story was really similar in terms of I got called to be into the Elders Quorum presidency, and that it was like a week later that everything fell down for me because I was again so gung ho and wanting to read everything. But sorry, I'm interrupting. Go ahead.
Oh no, it's good. You know, and from there on it's a fairly standard story. There's a slight variation in my case. So it was Old Testament that year, that was actually probably a good thing for me to try and teach, because one of the things in the back, you know, polygamy had never quite, you know, gelled in my head. And you know, the context of polygamy in the Mormon Church is always in terms of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Moses, David, Solomon. So I thought, cool, this will be the chance to, you know, dig into the context, dig into the story, maybe understand it a little bit better. So I started reading all kinds of academic literature on the Bible, learning about the cultures, learning about the languages, learning about the history. I very quickly realized that it's impossible to read the King James version of the Old Testament and get anything out of it. So I got a scholarly, you know, the Oxford Annotated Bible, which is much easier to read and has much better study aids. Anyway, so I'm reading along, and you know, more and more, it's just not making sense as to the LDS Church being a restoration of anything in the past. You know, the notions of priesthood don't match up. The notions of what a prophet is don't match up. And so throughout the school year, I'm, you know, in the back of my head, you know, all these issues are piling up, you know, but I am enjoying, you know, what I'm reading. I'm enjoying the biblical studies, the more academic approach to it, learning about the languages and the culture and whatnot. Towards the end of the year, I'd started reading more about church history because, you know, the answers for polygamy were not in the Old Testament or any, you know, anything about the context of the ancient Near East. And so I did start reading more into church history and doctrine, and, you know, more and more, it was just, you know, the more I read, the worse it got. And I got this idea in the back of my head that if I just read it all, I'll hit the bottom of the barrel at some point. And I didn't know that there is no bottom to that barrel. It is a never ending pit of despair and crap. And so reading and reading and reading, finally, I think it was in April, I read the story of Helen Mar Kimball. And that something in the back of my mind snapped. Because
that's the 14-year-old?
That's the 14-year-old girl, yeah.
Yeah.
And the reason it snapped for me was at the time, my little daughter is 2. And I'm thinking to myself, I would not trust Joseph Smith to be around my daughter if my life depended on it. I would not trust him. And then I realized, if I don't trust this guy to be around my daughter, why in the hell would I ever think he's a prophet of God? I mean, that seems to be a minimal requirement for prophetship. You know, you can trust them with your daughter and nothing's going to happen. And the next day I quit teaching seminary. It was, you know, it was very sudden. I said, I can't do this anymore. From then, it was kind of a slow burn out of the church. I tried to maintain activity for a while. I got a calling, like being like the Weeblos leader, so I didn't have to do anything doctrinal or teach anything or testify of anything. And I tried to make it work. I did cling on to the Book of Mormon because when I was a teenager, you know, I read the Book of Mormon and I liked the teachings, the theology. You know, it always brought me a lot of comfort to read it. So I kind of clung to that. And then the final thing that really was the final nail in the coffin when I said I can't pretend anymore was the Book of Abraham. You know, for me, that's the smoking gun. Joseph Smith could not have possibly screwed up something more than that. I mean, he made sure there was a crack in every little thing he did on that. You know, everything was completely wrong. And from there, I had still had maintained faith in God and in Jesus, had continued my studies in, you know, in academic biblical literature. By this point, I'd learned ancient Greek, so I could read the New Testament in Greek. So I felt confident that, you know, I could make my own decision, an informed decision about faith and continuing faith because of that background. And I eventually joined a local United Methodist congregation, which is where I go to church now. My wife is still fully in the LDS church, so we kind of live a religiously segregated home life, and that's my story.
Well, how does that work with the kids?
For the most part, she takes them to LDS church on Sunday, and then throughout the week, we do Bible study my way, and I, with my son, who's now 13 and is a pretty bright kid, we'll talk theology and we'll talk philosophy. So I've kind of taken the approach of, I don't want to make the church attendance a huge issue, because I'd rather my kids, if they decide to not be Mormon, to do so for an intellectually informed reason, not because mom and dad are fighting over it and mom and dad are being jerks to each other and making it a problem for them. So, I mean, I don't know if that's the right decision, but it's worked for us so far.
So in all of your studies, and you're obviously, you name your computer programs after philosophers like Kant, who was an atheist.
No, Kant was not an atheist. He was a deist.
Oh, yeah, deist. Okay.
He was not an atheist. He just believed in, religion within reason alone is what he called it.
Right. Okay. Thanks for the correction. So what is it that kept you adhered to Christianity? And what's your relationship to the Bible? Does it have authority? How do you if you're not a literalist, how do you discern between what's literal and what's figurative?
Yeah, sure. I think the reason I stayed in was as I was studying my way out of the LDS Church, I did keep coming back to Jesus in the New Testament, and I found Jesus' teachings extremely compelling. One of the things that I really realized is that how radical of a person he was. You know, I think in the LDS Church, you picture Jesus' white shirt, tie, you know, hair combed back. You know, we'll give him the beard just because we can't take it away from him. But
he definitely has blue eyes.
He definitely has blue eyes. You know, yeah, right. He definitely would stand up and, you know, and testify and, you know, wear a Mr. Max suit and, you know, whatever. but I found a Jesus who was totally unlike Mormonism. And for me, it was, you know, I, for lack of a better term, I fell in love with his teachings, with his life, with his example, with his death, and also with, you know, the early Christian witness of him, you know, the witness of the resurrection, Paul's ideas of you know, a universal, you know, religion that would transcend Jew and Gentile, that was a salvation through grace, not by works. You know, I generally, as I was doing my academic study of I don't want to say, I'm not an academic, but as I was reading the more academic literature, I found that there was sufficient evidence for at least large portions of the Bible, you know, large enough portions of the Bible to make it an interesting book to read and believe in. And I also found one of the things I really, that kept me in Christianity is the amount of free thought that generally happens inside Christianity. You know, you're allowed to disagree. You're allowed to think. You're allowed to philosophize. You don't have a predetermined conclusion for you know a large portion of Christianity. You know, there's a small kernel that you know is pretty non-negotiable. You know, the resurrection of Christ, his deity, you know, things attached to that. But beyond that, you know, there's a lot of room for thought. There's a lot of room for reflection, for you know, basically just you know, being a thoughtful person, and that also attracted me as well.
I've got a question about that because, like, historically speaking, that's not true, right? I mean, basically, there was a lot of you know Sturm und Drang over all of the councils on you know through the years. The you know the notion of heresy was really, really determinative of the history of Christianity. You know the problems about canonization, all that sort of stuff with the Bible, all of the religious wars in the 1500s, 1600s. All of that sort of stuff is not a history of free thinking. It's a pretty modern notion, and it's not established in the Bible itself or even in any of the traditions. So how is it that you reconcile that history of lack of free thought with the possibility now, which doesn't seem to be derived from the Bible or the history of the church?
Well, like you said, I mean, free thinking in general is a modern Western notion. You don't even really see it before, I would say, the 18th century. You know, so was Christianity free thinking before then in the modern sense? No. Was there discussion and debate? I think there was, you know, like you bring up, you know, conciliarism, you know, just the fact that people would get together to kind of debate and hash out what we're going to believe, you know, denotes a certain amount of, at least at the top levels, which, you know, for all intents and purposes, that was the literate classes. Those were the only people that could even, you know, have an intellectual debate. You know, there is some give and take. But I also think that, you know, a lot of what we take for granted in free thought and free thinking is kind of born out of the early modern period of the Protestant Reformation, where people kind of decided, yeah, we are going to talk about these things. And, you know, that's not entirely, it's not 100% why we have, you know, this modern notion of free thinking and deciding for yourself. You know, not at all, but it is a contributing factor to that. And I, you know, the idea of free thought is born in a Christian West, and I don't think you can separate the two. You don't really see that notion developing. Well, as far as I know, maybe somebody knows more about history. You don't see that developing in other places.
Was it because of Christianity or in spite of Christianity?
It's both. I mean, it's a real complicated mix of of Christianity in some cases saying, no, we're not going to discuss this. In other cases saying, yes, we are going to discuss this. And in other cases, you know, it being neutral. I don't think you can take a monolithic approach and say Christianity is against free thinking, is for free thinking. You know, it depends on the context. But, you know, in the modern world, you know, ever since basically, I would say the mid to late 19th century, you know, especially in the United States and in Western Europe, the idea is that, you know, there is more or less, you know, you're allowed to discuss, to debate, to disagree, and still, you know, go to the same church and fellowship with each other. So, yeah, there is much less, you know, doctrinal ironclad orthodoxy in this day and age.
Stay tuned for part two of The Problem of Evil.
Problem of evil really comes up when it comes to the notion of gratuitous suffering. It isn't just the fact that there's evil. It's the fact that it's so extensive, brutal, unremitting. So much of it is clearly pointless, or it seems to be clearly pointless. And it's sort of that enormous excess that turns it into a pressing problem.
The end of Job sounds a lot more to me like somebody who is chiding themselves. And I've always believed that we're a lot harder on ourselves than God will ever be on us.
The problem of evil is the best argument against God, and it is the one that causes me the most thought. So for me, this is the hardest thing that a believer in God has to deal with.
Dog thing and mediocre is my every thought. I feel like a vacuum cleaner, a complete sucker.
Hi. This is Hillary.
Matthew, Ryan,
Carol,
Keith,
Ashley,
and I like to play bingo online while listening to Infants on Thrones.
You can comment on this episode on the website, infantsonthrones.com.
And if you really like what you hear, give The Quorum a 5-star rating and write a short review on iTunes.
I did. Anyone for the closing prayer?
Now we call upon the author to explain. All right, yeah. Where rampant discrimination, mass poverty, third world debt, infectious disease, global inequality, and deepening socioeconomic divisions. Well, it does in your brain. We call upon the author to explain. Oh, now hang on, my friend Doug is tapping on the window. Hey, Doug, how you been? A book on Holocaust poetry complete with pictures, and then he tells me to get ready for the rain, and we call upon the author to
say, thank you for listening to Infants on Thrones.